This episode of The Boat Geeks is sponsored by The Boater's Guide, a free app for Pacific Northwest boaters. The Boater's Guide is adventure and information right at your fingertips, right when you need it. Find your happy place with The Boater's Guide, a free download on your phone or tablet in the App Store and Google Play.
In this episode of The Boat Geeks, we have South African sailor, cyclist, and adventurer Kirsten Neuschafer. And in honor of Women's History Month, we have a guest who is out there making history.
You know, you listed the things that she does, and I think you should just add, she's just superhuman. Yes. This woman is
her list of accomplishments.
Amazing. She's inspirational.
Yeah.
For everyone, not just for women.
Absolutely.
Or girls.
Oh, I was inspired. I was motivated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sail around the world in a race, but I'm thinking about going on a long bicycle ride.
There you go. Not 15,000 kilometers plus.
I'm not going to do a continent.
No.
Jeez.
Yeah. So amazing person. First woman to compete in the Golden Globe race and the first woman to win, along with a list of other accomplishments. So on this episode of The Boat Geeks, here we are, Kirsten Neuschafer. Welcome to another episode of The Boat Geeks. I am your host, Darren.
And I'm your other host, Darren.
When I was a young man, I wanted to be two things when I grew up. I wanted to be an adventurer, and I wanted to be a rock star. Our guest today is both a rock star adventurer. Our guest today is Kirsten Neuschafer, South African sailor, cyclist, adventurer. Now, bear with me. This list is long.
Kirsten, you'll have to bear with
us.
I mean, you hear this all the time, but anyway.
Winner of the 2022 Golden Globe race, first woman to complete the GRR, first woman to win the GRR, first woman to win any round-the-world race by the Three Great Capes, first South African sailor to win an around-the-world event. Now, these are some of the pronunciation. I might get them incorrect, but pardon me, awarded the Rod Stevens Seamanship Trophy by the Cruising Club of America and the Ocean Cruising Club's Seamanship Award for her role in a rescue operation, which we'll get to.
Amazing.
Yes. Named the female 2023 Rolex World Sailor of the Year, won Sailor of the Year and British Marine Outstanding Achievement of the Year from the 2023 British Yachting Awards, Women's World Sailor of the Year 2023, the Bobby Shank Cape Horn Award, Blue Water Medal from the Cruising Club of America, had a song on the Minnehaha written about her and her journey. And so I started at first writing down, you know, wherever I saw references to you popping up in the media. Well, it's all media around the world. Every major media outlet has featured Kirsten, as well as, of course, every sailing magazine. So we are so honored to have you here, Kirsten, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Really nice to be here.
Yeah, it is a very stormy day here in Port Ludlow in Port Townsend area.
Nothing that she's ever faced.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm sure.
We'll get to that because I've seen some of the videos. And I wanted to say, you know, as I said, when I was younger, I wanted to be, I saw myself as being an adventurer when I grew up. I think somewhere in my late teens, fear started creeping into my mind. I grew up in Santa Cruz, California. I was a surfer, snowboarder. And I was, you know, when I started, I was somewhat fearless. I would do risky things to where I could have broken my neck or, you know, whatever. And as I got older, fear started creeping into my thoughts and my, before I would decide whether I would want to do something or not. And that's why I wore my monster shirt, because I feel like something happened with you or didn't happen to where you remained fearless as you kept getting older, or you learned how to face your fears, which I do believe that's an element of it, because I heard you talking about that in some previous interviews. You just kind of blow my mind is how you just face your fears. You've done things that not in a million years would I do, but I love watching what you do and, you know, living vicariously through you. So, thank you for opening my eyes to a world of adventure that you've taken part in, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Very nice to be here on the show.
So, boy, where do you start with a life like this?
Well, I mean, we typically, because we're the boat geeks,
yeah,
we usually have folks on the show that are geeky about boats in one way or another.
Yeah.
And we always like to start by finding out where that seed
was first planted.
Yeah. So when did you first develop a love for or a desire to be on the ocean on a boat?
Well, I grew up in South Africa inland, and if I was lucky, we'd go down to the sea once a year. Mm-hmm. And I loved being at the sea. So that was sort of a starting point of, I wish I could be living at the sea and, if possible, on the sea. And I loved being in the water, so I considered myself a real water baby. I liked any water sports. And the first time I actually got to sail was on a dam inland, a green, slimy, mm-hmm. man-made lake, where you're likely to pick up bilharzia or something like that. And it was probably on an Optimist or something, and mm-hmm. I just realized I loved it. So I think that's where the seed was planted, in going for a little sail on an Optimist on a slimy dam as a kid.
That is somewhat a universal description.
Yeah.
I mean, so many kids mm-hmm. get on boats and have this, it's either a sense of freedom or adventure. What was that sense that you got that drove you to keep going?
Well, I think the other thing that drove me as a kid was I loved being in the outdoors, and it didn't really matter what it was, whether it was hiking, cycling, camping. I just liked being in nature, and I loved to explore. So the combination of having had a few good experiences on a boat with the idea of I'd like to see the whole world if possible.
Wow.
Seemed like a good combination, you know. It just seemed like, well, the sea must be the road to everywhere.
Which it is. Yeah. 70% of everywhere, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I my daughter has started sailing locally through the Maritime Center and is racing those little starter boats. And I wish she was here to meet you. That does seem like a common seed for people, is sailing young and getting that experience of freedom.
Yeah.
You know, you can't drive when you're a kid or whatever, so but you can get out on the water and sail. I think in terms of geeking out on a boat, we're definitely going to geek out on the famous Minnehaha, but we'll wait for a little bit. When did your seeking adventure start on a serious note, like where you were tackling something major? Was it the bike ride when you were 22?
Yeah, I think for me it started before the bike ride. I mean, when I finished high school, I was going to take a gap year and then come back and study, but a gap year turned into five. One of those years was the bike ride. But in those years, I mean, they weren't serious adventures in that you needed serious logistics and stuff behind it, but one cool adventure, for example, was I really wanted to get up to the Arctic. So I went up to the north of Norway, Tromsø, and I hitched a ride to Svalbard on a cargo ship. So it was an adventure where it didn't require me to do much other than ask, can I please have a ride? And I'm happy to scrub decks and peel potatoes, you know. But it was an adventure, and it was a sea adventure, and it took me up to the Arctic, which was such an amazing place for a South African to land up in. So, yeah, and one thing, you know, just led.
When was that? How old were you?
I must have been about 19 then. So.
Man. So you just always had the bug to just get out there and do stuff, experience life.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the more I did it, the more I wanted it, you know, and the less of the fear factor there was, the more it became a normal thing.
Yeah, I was going to get into that. Now, we say bike ride, but that's obviously, where did you start?
The bike ride, I started in Berlin in Germany.
Yeah.
I finished back home in South Africa.
So like,
how many miles was that?
Well, it was 15,000 kilometers, over 15,000 kilometers.
That's about what it was.
Wow. 15,000. Insane. That is so. Now, and you were being told that by people when you were preparing for this or talking about it, that that it was going to be dangerous. Was that true? Like, now, I totally appreciate your mentality of just one step at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go here and see what it's like. Mm-hmm. And then you ended up making it all the way to South Africa. But was it dangerous? Were they right?
I mean, I survived it unscathed. So maybe it wasn't dangerous. And danger is kind of a relative thing. Or what is the idea of danger? For example, a lot of people said it's particularly dangerous for you as a young woman all on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that was true. I think I was in many respects less in danger as a young woman all on my own, because people had this desire to protect and help me. So they invited me in wherever they could, any village I passed, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure that that was the truth. I can see why people might think that would be the case, but having experienced it myself, I don't think it was.
I think that happens often. People have perceptions, and they're probably being protective of you. They didn't want to see any harm come to you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What were some of the more memorable moments of that ride down Africa?
Well, I mean, the whole ride was pretty amazing, memorable. The scenery changed from, you know, the Sahara Desert to the Central African jungle to back into the Namib Desert, and, you know, amazing people that I met. I mean, some of the highlights were just meeting some of the poorest of the poor, but yet the most generous and hospitable people you could possibly ever wish for. Mm-hmm. So it was a very diverse trip, and culturally very diverse, and in its entirety, it was, you know, incredibly special. Even the hard times, like I got malaria quite badly in the Central African Republic, and I had a family there looking after me as though I was their own. You know, they would have gone to the end of the world to try and do whatever they could to see me get well again. Wow. So, yeah.
How long did it, from beginning to end, did this journey take?
It was a year, roughly on a year.
Did it prepare you, looking back, for your journeys that were ahead of you?
I mean, I think I did. I think every little journey contributed in some or other way.
Yeah.
So whether it was just to face a fear factor, for example, or, you know, one of the things it did prepare me for was the fact that a lot of people will tell you it's impossible and that it might well be possible. So, you know, it definitely affirmed in my mind that you've got to at least give it a try.
Great. That is awesome. I was also kind of browsing around videos on YouTube of you, and I saw you in a plane, and I noticed something. The propeller wasn't moving. The camera went forward, and you were gliding. That must have been awesome. How recent was that, though?
That was quite recent. That was probably a few months ago. Yeah.
Okay, so are you pursuing flying, or was that a one-time experience?
It was a one-time experience where someone said, would you like to fly in a glider plane? And I said, sure, I'd definitely like to. So, I mean, you know, if I got more opportunities like that, I'd definitely take them.
Yeah. So it was amazing, I'm assuming.
Yeah, very cool.
And you have to try it once.
Oh, yeah.
Once in your life. You can't compare it to any other experience.
If you're going to be in a plane and the engine isn't working, a glider is what I would want to be in, yes. Did you find any similarities between being in a glider and sailing? The wind and the quiet?
Beyond Bernoulli's principle.
Yes.
Well, for example, what I found very interesting on that glider was that it had little telltales on the screen bubble in front, and the pilot was telling me how you sort of make sure that you've got the right attitude and everything with your plane by looking at the telltales.
Wow.
So that was really interesting. And I think definitely it seemed like there were a lot of similarities. And I was speaking to the pilot afterwards, because he's also a sailor, and I was saying, yeah, you know, but you're dealing with three dimensions here, whereas on a sailboat it's only two dimensions. And he said, that's true, but you're dealing with two different elements when you're sailing.
Point.
So very interesting.
There's a lot of sailors and pilots and crossovers. I mean, I look out here, and we know many pilots that own sailboats.
And if you hang around pilots, they talk like sailors do. They love their planes like we love our boats. And
yeah.
So I would say, just looking at your life, you're an all-around adventurer. Obviously, it has been focused on the sailing aspect. Is there any other adventure you're pursuing? Is there things that you still want to do that you haven't done yet? Or you climb Everest? Or
yeah. Well, I'd love to sail the Northwest Passage. That would be really cool. Yeah. So I'd love to explore a bit of Alaska, and even this coastline looks absolutely stunning. So, I mean, none of these are winning races or setting records or anything like that. But, yeah, just for the enjoyment of it and to discover.
Yeah, it is. It is beautiful up there. Yeah. I've been once. Amazing. Untouched scenery, you know.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of the race to Alaska?
Well, more and more talk of this has been coming my way.
So we can hope.
Yeah. So, you know, I've had the great privilege of meeting Jean Gossef.
Yes.
And hearing firsthand from her about her experiences, you know. And yeah, I have to think more and more often about the race to Alaska now.
Yeah. And Jean is right behind us. yeah. So we will have her on the show as soon as possible as well, if she will grace us.
Yeah.
But it would be great to see you up here in our corner of the world for sure.
Maybe we can get Bruce Schwab, Gene, and Kirsten to be on a boat.
Yeah, the super crew, right?
Yeah. Everybody else would say, all right, I quit.
Yeah.
I'm not even gonna try.
So now I love talking about boats because boaters are always very passionate about boats. But I wanted to talk about one boat in particular before we get to Minnehaha. You were, prior to doing the race, you were working on a boat, I want to pronounce it correctly, Pelagic.
Mm-hmm.
That looked like a very interesting vessel. Like the way you were describing it, my interest in boats is exploration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as adventurous as you are. But just the idea, I've always loved, you know, since I was a kid, watching Star Trek or starships, you know, exploring, you know, the galaxy. That's what I've always been drawn to with boats, is just getting out and seeing stuff that other people have seen, sure, but I haven't seen, you know, and exploring, especially up here in the Pacific Northwest. That boat just seemed like a dream boat.
It's a very cool boat. I'd call it the 4x4 of the seas.
You know? That's a great description.
You can go anywhere with a boat like that.
Yeah.
So built for high latitude, super strong, but it had a lot of, you know, very specific features. For example, it had a 7-ton lifting keel, which was fantastic because it meant that you could rapidly reduce your draft and go into really shallow little bays and stuff like that, which especially for the areas we were going to could be really important to, for example, get away from icebergs, because the icebergs can't get into these little bays. And the rudder could also lift, and you could unpin the keel. So if you were in poorly charted water and there was, you know, a chance of hitting a rock or something like that, the keel would just swing back without doing any structural damage. So there were a lot of cool features like that on that boat.
So you were working with Skip Novak. Can you tell us a little bit about what that job was, who he is, and what you're doing?
So I was working for him as one of his skippers. So at the time he had two boats, Pelagic, the little boat, the original steel one, and then Pelagic Australis. And he'd basically, offer high latitude charters, mainly to Antarctica, Patagonia, South Georgia, sometimes Falkland Islands, on these boats. And we'd take anything from mountaineers to scientists to film crew, like National Geographic and BBC, and then we'd go take them to wherever they wanted to go. And yeah, and those were the boats we used.
That must have been so fun.
It was. It was a hard job because you did everything. You were the skipper and the cleaner and the cook and the dinghy driver, and sometimes you carry the tripods up the mountain as well. But we got to meet some really interesting clients because it was the kind of boats and charters that attracted interesting people, and we got to see some super, super interesting places.
I bet.
Yeah.
So prior to, again, becoming a racer, you were a working skipper, right? So
and a delivery skipper as well, right?
Yep.
That's an interesting career path.
What I love is that you bicycle all the way down Africa. You get to, where did you?
Cape Agulhas.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then you're just like, all right, I'm gonna get out in the ocean. And I love your just obviously you put a lot of thought into what you're doing, but it just seems like you're just from one adventure to the next. And and I love it. You kind of step off that cliff into, you don't know what's ahead of you. So what was that like, the years of being a working skipper and delivery captain and all that?
Yeah, it was, you know, they were good years. They were fun years that I was always learning more and more. So sometimes when I think of the Golden Globe race and I think of my years of working as a delivery skipper and then as a charter skipper, it felt like every little bit that I did was preparation towards this big challenge that I didn't know at the time I was going to do. So,
right.
So yeah, I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed not really having a 10-year plan or any long vision. I've always enjoyed life to be like that, do one thing, and then when it's time to move on, then move on to the next thing. So.
I totally respect that.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that are either watching or listening going, I wish I could do that.
Yes. And you know, I it's a choice, right?
Yeah.
But life is just interesting. The way you envision your life when you're younger and then the way things change. But again, you know, like, I totally love people like you because I can live vicariously through you. And it's something I do on a regular basis. I work in front of my computer every day, you know, so just being able to see people that live life like you do, it's very inspirational, motivational. And yeah, it just made me want to adventure more. Although, like I said, there's things I will never, ever, ever do, like latch the tiller to the side and jump off my boat.
That, when you describe that, and experiencing the vastness.
I get it, 100%.
I mean, wow, that is.
But never in a million years.
Moments like that, what, one thousandth of a percent of humans get to probably experience at that level. I mean, it's not very many people that get to do that.
Yeah, that's true. And in that sense, it's really a privilege to be able to do
to
these things.
To be able to. Yeah.
See these kind of things. And I mean, I'm the same. I also look at what other adventurers are doing, and there's some really crazy, amazing stuff out there, and that keeps on inspiring me to want to do other stuff as well. So.
It's like when Bruce was sitting here and we asked him about the race to Alaska, and he's like, people thought I was crazy sailing around the world on my own, you know, solo. And then you've got somebody paddleboarding to Alaska.
Yeah.
He goes, at least I'm not doing that.
Yes. So
I guess there's limits for everybody, but.
Absolutely. Now, you were talking about, she's also extremely humble. I've seen in all your interviews, you talk about being privileged, and you compared it to your mom and your mom's generation, and that we live at a time where you were able to, you know, you had the opportunity to do something like this. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, just how that, you know, maybe seeing your mom growing up and then being presented with all these opportunities and how your mom has responded to you, you know, my girl's an adventurer and she's going to go out there and face the world.
Slay the dragon.
Yeah.
It seemed like she was very happy and proud of you.
She was very supportive as well. And it's interesting looking back over how she's changed since the day I was 18 and I left home and didn't come back for 5 years. And when I came back on a bicycle to, you know, her thinking she's never going to see me again. And she wishes I just was, you know, studying and then doing something normal, to, my telling her, for example, you know, I want to do this Golden Globe race and this is what it's about. And her saying, that's incredible. You must do it. And then supporting me with, you know, with her heart and her soul. So it's pretty amazing to see her evolution over the times that I've been doing these things and to see how she's gotten used to it, accepted it, and now is even proud of
embracing it. Embracing it and, being a part of it with you. I saw her meeting you at the end of the race. I saw that video. Brought tears to my eyes.
Oh, wow,
Definitely. I could just tell she was so proud of you, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it really has been amazing, and thank goodness she was there. Otherwise, I might have wanted to just sail over the finish line and swing a left and keep going.
Yes, for sure.
But yeah, it's been great having a supportive mother like that.
Now, we have our daughters are 13. We met each other because our daughters were in the same second grade class.
Okay,
And one of my favorite and my daughter's favorite books for bedtime story was 50 Famous Women Scientists. And there's two volumes. And,
oh, wow. Okay.
And we'd go through and you know, reading about a British paleontologist who discovered fossils but wasn't allowed to take credit for discovering them because back then women weren't allowed.
Right.
And to see, you know, generation by generation by generation. And Darren and I are, you know, we're trying to raise two people, not women necessarily, but equal footing, equal everything. And still, 2024, there's still levels that we have to try to push through. And it's just, it seems so strange to me. And it, but it's a constant battle. Are you still finding that you're butting your head against the men's world in various places?
It's an interesting question. You know, in my career path as a sailor, initially I found that I had to like really forge my way through. I found I had to work really hard to prove that I could do the same and that I was capable in the same way. And I often had to be really assertive, as in say, I'm not interested in your first mate job. Give me a skipper job or don't call me, you know.
Right.
But when it came to the race, I didn't feel in the least but in any way disadvantaged. I had so much support, so much encouragement from men, from women, didn't really matter. So I really felt when I was at the start line, I was there absolutely as an equal as all the others were.
I love it.
Yeah.
Although you were the only woman on that race, right?
Yeah, which is surprising to me. It's surprising.
Yeah, it was to me as well.
Yeah. But yeah.
So we can approach the Golden Globe now, but how did you set your sights on the Golden Globe? Was it something, you know, many years prior you saw it on your radar, or how did that come about?
Well, actually, it wasn't something over many years. I only figured out that the 2018 edition was on when it had already started, and it was maybe, you know, a quarter way through already. Then someone told me about it and I started following it loosely. And the more I followed it, the more the idea of doing a retro race like that without modern technology started to intrigue me. And that's where the seed got planted. And I thought and I thought, and then I started talking about it and more. And eventually people said, stop talking about it, do it, you know.
So this race is based on the original, what was
1968.
What was the person's name that did it?
Robin Knox Johnston.
Okay, so 1968, he does a solo around the world, unassisted with obviously technology from that era. And so that spawned this race. When was the first race after that?
And 50 years later, in 2018.
Wow. Okay. So it's a retro race around the world, unassisted, using technology and gear that was only available to you in 1968, except for obviously the boats, right? The boats could be a little bit older.
1988
The designs had to predate 1988, but basically they were all supposed to be quite similar to Sir Robin Knox Johnston's boat. So similar size and, you know, long keel boats with rudders attached to the keel and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
So this race really piqued my interest just because of the way it was set up and being a retro race. And what I loved is in one of your videos, you were describing that it wasn't just a race. It was also an adventure because there's so many elements. I mean, I would imagine any ocean race is to a certain extent an adventure and unknown, because you don't know what the weather's going to bring. You don't know what is going to break or whatever. But I love that aspect. And you seemed really passionate about loving the fact that it was an adventure and there was so much unknown ahead of you.
Yeah. And that was really the attraction for me in this race, because I've never raced before.
Right.
So when this race came up, I'm like,
isn't that unbelievable?
That's great.
Basically, when I looked at this race, I said to myself, that is my cup of tea. Yeah. I want to do this. You know,
so. That totally makes sense. It seems to fit you. Now, have any other racers been frustrated with that fact? You're like, I want a race. You enter a race and you win. Like,
I mean, people have tried.
People have spent their whole lives trying to win races and so forth.
Well, I don't know, because if there are frustrated people, they haven't necessarily told me.
Yeah.
But I know there was quite a bit of commentary before the race saying, she doesn't have racing experience. She's more of an adventurer. So, you know, and there was also quite a bit of, you know, her boat's quite heavy. So she's probably on the slow boat to China and all that kind of thing. So, but
Well, speaking of the boat.
Perfect time to geek out.
Our local Cape George boat builder.
Yeah.
Right here in the neighborhood.
How did you find Minnehaha?
Well, I was working on Pelagic in Maine at the time I decided to sign up for the race. And then I thought, well, okay, I'm in North America, so let me see what's on the North American market and just go and explore and, you know, study and research, because I had to choose the right boat. And then someone in Seattle, a woman living in Seattle, actually said, hey, what about the Cape George? Now, the Cape George wasn't on the pre-approved list, but it ticked all the boxes, so it was going to work. And just looking at the numbers, it had the longest water line. Okay, it was heavy, but it had, you know, a big rig to carry a lot of sail area. And it just, by the numbers, it looked like it could be a boat that could compete with the Wrestler 36. And I did not want a Wrestler 36. And the more people said that's the only boat you can use for this race, the more I decided I don't want that boat. I want to do it my way.
So. Now, I'm not familiar with the boat, but was it because people were saying that's the boat you have to use that you didn't like it? Or were there particular aspects of that yeah. boat that you didn't like?
Well, for one, there weren't any to even be seen in North America, because they're all in Britain or around Europe. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going to, you know, fly across the pond to go and look at a boat.
Right.
And yeah, it just looked like quite a plain boat to me. I'm sure it's a very good boat, but mm-hmm. I just thought it would be nice to do it on another boat, because it seemed like everyone believed that that was the yeah. only boat that could win.
So. Did you have a target list of maybe two or three different types of manufacturers or boats, or did you zero in on the Cape George right away?
Yeah, I looked at various different boats, from the really small light ones to, you know, whatever was in the area and that I could mm-hmm. easily get access to. But then when the Cape George popped up on my radar, I just started yeah. really focusing on it. And then I started looking at which Cape Georges were on the market, and there weren't many, there were three. And I went to, the first one I went to look at was standing in Newfoundland. And for me, it's like just a thing with boats. When you see them, you know, that's it. Mm-hmm. And I knew mm-hmm. when I saw that boat, you know, she was standing on the hard. She looked like she needed a lot of TLC and, you know, she was half covered and I couldn't even see properly, but I saw that boat and I knew it. I knew my search has come to an end.
That's awesome. Yeah.
She found you.
Yeah. Now, Cape Georges are also known for a range of interior finish, because some were factory finished mm-hmm. by the Cape George yard and others were built as hulls and cabin tops and given to the owner to finish. What was Minnehaha's history like?
Minnehaha was built in the yard in Port Townsend, and that was pretty cool as well, because I contacted Todd at the yard and I said, look, this is, you know, what I want to do and this is the boat I'm looking at. And he said, yeah, we know that boat.
Yeah.
She was built here. So, awesome. So that was very cool. And they were a huge support throughout the refit. You know, I'd often phone Todd and I'd say, you know, we're busy fixing this, that, and the next thing. And say, okay, this is how we do it here. So it was a pretty cool, you know, working relationship with them.
I, at one point, and this is probably around 1999, I was seriously considering a Cape George 36 pilot house.
Oh, okay.
It's a little teeny pilot house on yeah. on them, but in this region, sometimes it's raining like this.
Yeah.
sometimes. And so three of my sailboats have been pilot house models. I've always been a fan, but yeah, the Cape George, the boat itself for you ticked off a lot of boxes, and for just cruising in the Pacific Northwest does the same thing.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I wouldn't have wanted a different boat. I was 100% happy with my choice.
Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. So there's three on the market right now. I went on Yacht World last in North America.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But yeah, beautiful boats. And so I'm very pleased to have discovered what I already knew was a local boat and people loved them, but I got to delve more into it. So yours was a 1988 Cape George 36 built in the yard here in Port Townsend. Is this your first time here since getting the boat, refitting the boat, etc.?
Yeah, I came here before I actually purchased Minnehaha, because there was another boat here that was for sale. I looked at that boat, but I knew then already I don't really need to look at other boats. It's yeah. Minnehaha I want.
Yeah.
And I went to visit Todd them at in Port Townsend and see where the boat was built.
Yeah.
So, and it's now my first time back since
great.
That time.
Excellent. Well, welcome back.
Yeah.
Well, nice
yeah.
to be back.
Very special. So now Minnehaha means essentially waterfall. Is that something?
Yeah, like, I think it has kind of two meanings. Either it's a waterfall or a rapid, or it's a laughing water.
Yeah.
So, I like the last one.
Yeah.
Laughing water.
Yeah, I do. All right, let's get into this race. You know, the idea of, I was watching some videos, like, you know, right the weeks leading up, and they were talking about your mindset. I think somebody was wanting to like tour your boat or something like that, and you weren't available. Obviously, you were preparing. What were the weeks leading up to the race like for you, mentally and physically and everything?
Yeah, we had 3 weeks in Le Sable d'Olonne before the race, and those 3 weeks were really, really tough. Not because I had so many last minute things to do, which I did, because which boat was ever ready until it actually cast off. But just because we had so many events to attend and press conferences, and we were on a public dock, and now the French, of course, are crazy about sailing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from the tiniest little kid up to the oldest person there, they all know exactly who won, which Vendée win, and everything else, and they really want to talk to you. And you don't want to be rude and say, leave me alone, I'm busy doing my thing now, I need to focus on preparing for one of the biggest trips of my life.
But that's true.
You know, exactly. So you end up talking to the people, and you don't, and you want to just do your work. For example, I had to service my winches because I'd already sailed 15,000 miles with the boat. And I actually had to take the winches below deck with my bucket of petrol below deck, and I was getting high on petrol fumes down below because I couldn't work above deck without, you know, having people talk to me and wanting a selfie or an autograph or something like that. Right. So I found those last 3 weeks really, really stressful. And also they had a party every night on the dock, and I like sleeping on my boat, you know, it's my home. And if I wake up at 3 a.m, I want to start working.
Yeah.
But you couldn't sleep because there was this thing going on every single night with the same playlist every single night. So anyway, I was incredibly relieved to get over that start line when it finally happened.
I like the, you were doing a video and it was 3 hours after the start, and you were talking about how that's behind you, and you you finally, could just kind of see, you're just like,
I finally thought, I can get some sleep now.
So now, like you mentioned, and Bruce mentioned this too, like when he goes back to France, he gets a bit of a celebrity.
Yeah.
Is that now, you know, you can just go to France whenever you want and be treated like royalty?
Well, maybe Le Sable d'Olonne, but it's very specific to that little area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, it's just a little bit of an aside, but how has this transition been from Kirsten, the person, and you've been an adventurous sort, to Kirsten, the international celebrity? I mean, that's a bit of a difference, maybe?
Yeah, it is. And it's also a huge difference spending 8 months on your own, and then suddenly you've got all this stuff around, you know, media and interest and everything. It's been quite a transition. I mean, it's been now almost a year since I finished the race, and I still sometimes feel I haven't quite found my place where I belong. But it's also been so overwhelmingly positive and encouraging for me as well. It's been an opportunity for me to share my experience, which feels a little bit like time to give back, because I had so many people helping me to get to the start line. So I've seen it in a very positive sense. But I, on the same token, I've kind of also got itchy feet, and I wouldn't mind being out in the middle of the ocean all on my own again. So
it's got to be, definitely battling that feeling of wanting to be back to that, but also you got to appreciate a little bit of the, you know,
the love
that you're getting for all the hard work that you've put in over those years.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I feel like I'm riding out a very long positive wave right now.
Good.
That's really cool. And you're, I mean, our daughters, you're inspiring another generation, and not just girls.
No,
I mean, she inspired me. Human
big
beings,
time.
Which is really cool. So thank you for continuing to ride this wave, because you've ridden it right here.
Yeah, right to our studio. Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it.
We super appreciate it.
But let's get back out on the race.
Back to the race, because so how long did it take you, the whole,
235 days.
So that is a lot of time alone. So now you leave, you're 3 hours out in the race, you're able to breathe. At any point at the beginning there, did you go, what the hell have I gotten myself into? Or was it you were just going and you were good to go?
By then I was just going and I was good to go. And it just felt like, okay, here we go again, because I'd already done a couple of long passages with my boat. But I did have a time when I left Canada to sail back to South Africa after the refit, where I thought, what the hell have I gotten myself into there? So in a way, it was good because I had all the those moments already behind me by the time I started the race.
The proverbial shakedown cruise, right? Yeah.
Did anything specific happen that made you feel that way? Or
no, I guess it was just a time where I was filled with a lot of anxiety because the world was still a bit weird around COVID. I had to leave Canada to just come to that point where I had to leave. Minnehaha was ready, but it was winter.
Right.
And everyone was kind of getting ready for the winter, and I was getting ready to sail out into 50 knots, you know.
What's this person doing?
Exactly. And people were like, what are you doing? You know, I was asking fishermen to help me cast off the dock, and they're like, you sure you want to go out? It's blowing 40 knots in here, so it's blowing a lot harder out there. And I'm like, And then I was thinking, well, what am I doing? You know? And then, I got out there and I was seasick and it's blowing 50 knots and there are all sorts of leaks I didn't know through the portholes.
Yeah.
You know, so it was the first couple of rough days of thinking, what am I doing?
Well, that must have given you an incredible just boost of confidence in the boat as well, to be able to
absolutely
withstand.
It did. And it also showed me, you know, where the leaks were and what still needed to be repaired before the race.
So you're out there, the race has started, your days, weeks, and whatever. To me, it seems like a world of extremes. You have absolutely calm days that where it was like glass. Like I didn't believe that was real, but it was on video. So I know
like
it was.
It looked like AI.
Yeah,
almost,
it did. To the roughest weather that that's again where my fear kicks in. Major storms in the middle of the ocean. What was it like to just on a daily basis be experiencing such extremes?
I guess, you know, the extremes didn't necessarily go. Sometimes they did go from one day. You'd have one day of calm and frustration, and then the next day a nice big storm is coming through. I think for me, the calms were always difficult, no matter what, because you're always trying to move, and I always felt I'm doing more damage to my boat by keeping the sails slapping all over the show and slamming. And whereas the storms, I kind of knew I'm definitely going to see some of them. And if I don't want to see them, then I shouldn't be signing up for that race in the first place. And I mean, they're kind of energizing. So, and there's always something to do with a storm, and you can, you know, have your storm tactic or steer or whatever. Whereas when there's nothing, you're just sitting around waiting.
Now you entered this race with the desire to win. Yeah. You said some people enter with just the desire to survive or finish. So when it was calm like that, where you just and maybe the other sailors had some wind or something like that, was that just always on your mind?
It was pretty much always on my mind when it was calm. When it was a storm, for example, and I had to, you know, say one of the storms, I went as far as I could to the north to get away from the worst of it. And not once did I then think, oh, maybe I should stop going to the north now and start heading back for the Horn, because I don't want to fall behind. There it didn't matter anymore at all. It's like, whatever, I just want to make sure my boat doesn't come to grief. But with the calms, it was always in the back of my mind. I'm wasting time. I'm losing time. The others are catching up on me. So,
but it seemed like for moments, at least in the video, you were also able to go, but this is beautiful.
Yeah. If the calms didn't last for too long, you know, sometimes if it was a short-ish calm, it also gives you a bit of respite. Gives you a moment to just gather yourself and to tidy up and do whatever you have to do, even dive below and check for barnacles or whatever the case may be. So the calms had their useful moments, but if they were too extended, then they'd become pretty grating on the nerves.
What about sleep? Were you able to ever catch up? I mean, there's, you know, some people say you can never really catch up on sleep. You either don't have it and then you get sleep. But when you were becalmed, did you find yourself being able to rest and recharge physically a little bit more?
Again, if the calm didn't last too long, then it would sometimes be really nice. For example, I remember after the rescue, I had a night of calm, and that was really nice because I just slept. And then, you know, I was back in the race the next day. But if it was an extended calm, then I couldn't sleep anymore.
You're getting
because there
restless
was too much frustration. Okay. Yeah. And also because the boat has no rhythm. You know, it's just rolling backwards and forwards, and all it takes is a bolt in the bilge to roll backwards and forwards and drive you mental. You know, you just want to shut the thing up, but you can't. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So one of my favorite parts about being out on a boat is wildlife. And I saw that you saw a lot of birds, especially when storms would happen.
Yeah.
And what were some of the highlights in terms of the wildlife that you saw during the race?
Yeah, well, one of the highlights was definitely just off Cape Town. When I was approaching Cape Town for the photo gate, there were humpback whales all over, and they were surfacing right next to the boat. And it was a calm night. It was a moonlit night, and you could see these big bodies glistening in the moonlight and the spray wafting over. And that was amazing. And I was becalmed that night. So the next morning I was still drifting off Cape Town with amazing Table Mountain in the background. And these whales again surfacing right next to the boat. Normally you're not allowed approaching them within 200 meters, but in this case they were coming to me.
Yeah.
And that's often the benefit of the calms, is that in those moments the wildlife comes to check you out. Because they're just as curious about us, I think, as we are about
them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you have a sense in terms of all those 200 plus days, what the average sea state was that you experienced? I mean, is that even something to try to determine? I don't know. I mean, you can determine what your average speed is. Was over
distance
the entire,
traveled.
Which was what? What was your average speed?
Oh, if I took the 2 weeks of getting stuck in the doldrums, it would get to below five.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Remove those 2 days. What was an average sail speed?
You know, on an average day, I do between 120 and 150 miles, nautical miles a day. So
we're
looking at we're looking at 5 to 6.5 knots or something like that.
That we were guessing around six.
Yeah.
So, but the sea state.
The sea state. I think you could. I mean, you could probably average it out. Maybe average it out for the Southern Ocean, where the sea state was probably 2 to 4 meters, maybe 5 meters.
Just on average. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, and then of course you know, when outside of the Southern Ocean would have been considerably less, maybe 1 to 2 meters, something like that. So it's not like it was intense all the time. And even on the Southern Ocean, it's big swell, but it's not always steep, aggressive swell. So, you know, sometimes a 5 meter swell could feel quite smooth and gentle.
Hmm. Very nice.
Being limited to technology from 68 and before, were there any moments where that was frustrating?
Yes. And getting stuck for 2 weeks in the doldrums, it was incredibly frustrating because I didn't know where the others were. I didn't know how long the calms were going to last. I couldn't see how wide the doldrums were, and I just didn't know how long it was going to take for the wind to come back. So for me, the celestial navigation part actually eventually became quite an easy and obvious routine, but I found it more difficult not having weather information.
After the race and being able to use modern technology again, did you feel spoiled? Or how did it feel having all that available to you again?
Well, actually, I sailed after the race from France to Madeira, and I didn't even bother switching a GPS on. Because I was still in the mode, and I, you know, it's something I'd like to consistently keep on practicing when I go sailing, because otherwise you get rusty at it again.
Absolutely.
And it is very gratifying to be able to find a little island like Madeira just popping out of the ocean where you expected it to pop out of the ocean. But then of course it is very nice to have weather information. Then you do feel pretty spoiled. So
I take it for granted. Certainly. I love, you know, like I've taken some online courses and so forth, navigating with maps and charts and, but nowhere near being able to put it to practice. But, I mean, today's technology is incredible in terms of, both sailing and flying. Just modern technology makes things so much more safe and gives you greater awareness, obviously. Back to the race, there's so you lost fellow racers along the way, not their lives, thankfully. Early on, somebody got grounded and, you know, obviously, you know, again, this speaks to your being a good person. maybe some racers would be like, yes, another one's out. You know, one of my top competitors is out. And maybe it's not like that at all in the sailing world. I've known very competitive people that I can imagine being that way, but you were not happy. It's hard to see somebody that, you know, has put in as much work and has as high hopes as you do, being taken out of the race. let's talk about this rescue though. Like, this is a big deal. How did this all come about? Like, how were you made aware that something was going on, and what happened?
Well, we obviously, for, you know, all safety reason purposes, or for communicating with the race organizers, we had modern means. Mm-hmm. So we had the YB3 tracking devices that were our backup tracker in case the fixed installation failed. And with the race organizers could also send us messages. So if anything happened to any of the boats, they let all of us instantly know. So I got three messages, one after the next, on the YB3 tracking device to say, first was that Tapio Lehtinen's EPIRB had gone off. The second one was to say, confirmed his boat has sunk. The third one was to say he's safe in his life raft. So because I got them all three in one go, I knew there had been a time lag, that because, you know, for 12 hours I'd heard nothing.
Right.
So for some reason it hadn't come through to me. And then I also knew that I'm probably the most likely, I'm likely the closest person to him. So the first thing I did was get onto my sat phone and phone the race organizers and say, can I help? And they said, yes, you can. You're the closest to him. Can you go immediately to his assistance?
Wow.
The closest human being to him on the planet.
Yeah.
Yep.
And at what point are you located on the ocean where, how far from any point of land are you at this juncture?
So at this juncture, we were probably, I was probably about 500 miles off the coast of South Africa, in the Indian Ocean.
And he's just out there,
and he was
floating in a raft.
You said about 18 miles?
No.
Or 18 hours? I can't remember.
I got to him about 24 hours later, so he was about 100 miles or so roughly away. Yeah, and I mean, the Indian Ocean, the Southern Indian Ocean, can be quite a hostile place. It's, you know, when you think of it, you know, as someone who sails or spends time on boats, if you imagine someone else on a tiny little life raft. And you think of, you know, I mean, at the time was get to him before the wind picks up and the thing starts spinning on the surface of the ocean or something like
and
that.
And before you got the three messages and you confirmed everything and his position, you didn't know where anybody else was at that time?
I didn't really know where they were, but he and I had gone through the Cape Town gate almost at the same time, which is why I knew that I'm likely the closest to him.
Wow.
So what was it like when you were approaching? How did you find him and see him?
Well, firstly, we also had a grab bag that had a special seal, that if you opened it, they'd see that you'd opened it. Mm-hmm. But in that grab bag was a handheld GPS for emergencies like that. So obviously this was an emergency I was allowed to use the GPS, instructed to. So I then got his position. They gave me his position. I could put it into my handheld GPS and follow the director's course to him, which is what I did. And I guess the thing I was thinking about the whole time, because I was at the helm all night, I was wondering, what's he going to be like? Because he's just experienced something traumatic. He's seen his boat sink within less than half an hour beneath him and go down to the abyssal plain 3 kilometers below him. He's lost everything on board his boat, not to mention his boat. He's no longer in the race. Yeah. If it had been me, I'd have been pretty depressed.
Devastating, yes.
Devastated.
Right.
So I was wondering, what's he going to be like? But he was incredibly, incredibly positive. Like, he had already seen me before I could see him, and he was already on VHF contact with me. And he was calling me a lot. You know, I could tell he was anxious for me to arrive, and it was a little bit distracting, shall I say, because I was at the helm and I had to go down below and speak from the main VHF because the handheld wasn't picking up signal to him. So, you know, he's calling me, Minaha, Minaha, and I ran down because I think I better talk to the guy at something urgent. And then he says, you'll never believe it, but there's a turtle right here.
Wow.
You know, and then I almost said, really, take a photo of it. And I'm like, oh, no, shut up. Maybe he doesn't have his camera with him. So.
Wow.
So my point being is, he was just as enthused about life as ever.
You know, he was happy to be alive.
Yeah, well, he was enjoying the wildlife around him. He was getting all excited about me popping up at some other point. And, you know,
that's great.
What was the cause of the sinking?
It's kind of unknown. At the time, the hour or whatever he spent on board Minnehaha, he said he thought that there might have been a leak through a through hull, and then it eventually burst the watertight bulkhead or something like that. But you know, because he said the flood came from the back, so it's not like he collided with something, and it wasn't extreme weather or anything like that. But you know, there are other theories that maybe his hull sprung a crack because he was pushing the boat hard and he had a super strong, stupid, tense, tight rig. I don't know. You know, I think it's just one of those mysteries because the boat's at the bottom of the ocean. No one will ever really know what
happened.
That's
right. So, yeah. And it wasn't as sturdy as a Cape George, obviously.
did you see any, there's containers out there floating, but did you see anything floating in the ocean that caused you to go, wow, I'm glad I didn't come close to that?
No.
Good.
No, nothing really.
Good.
Never anything like a big log or a thing where I thought that could have been a bad collision. Yeah.
But it does bring, you know, make the point that anything can happen at any point, and you have to be prepared for that. You know, like just being out in the middle of the ocean and a half hour later, your boat's gone.
Yeah. And not even in, you know, really bad conditions or anything like that.
Yeah. So, like just an unknown situation. Yeah.
That's
so,
probably a benefit that it happened in those. I mean, if it would have happened in.
Oh, yeah. A storm,
you know, a really bad storm that might have been anything could have been problematic.
Yeah. That could have been bad because you know, being in a little life raft like that in a bad storm, you know, I think if it's a really bad storm, that little life raft's probably gonna, you know, capsize and do all sorts of.
But he got to look at turtles and wildlife instead, and had a good ending, or as good as could be. So, not only detoured to rescue a fellow racer, but then when I feel like this is a movie in the making. Have you sold the rights already? I mean, this is a movie.
It is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I hope you benefit from that in the future. Okay. So you performed this rescue. How far in was this for the race?
So this was less than halfway. This was, you know, just over a quarter way into the race, I'd say.
Yeah. So
I remember when, I mean, this was on
news,
the news. Yeah. I was on our local news. Huh. So, you know, that went well. And obviously people who are boaters and sailors, they
pick up on
your radar
stuff.
Picks up on that.
Yeah.
But it was general news around the world at the time.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So as you're continuing with the race, are you feeling like you're ahead? Are you feeling good about the race? Do you have a sense that you're a contender? You know, halfway, three quarters through the race, do you have any idea?
Yeah, I after the rescue, because before the rescue, I was struggling quite a lot with calms, and I couldn't get away from them because the southern limit didn't allow you to go further south. Mm. And I was getting frustrated because I had a chart, an old chart I've used before for crossing the Southern Indian Ocean, and I could see that I'd been way further south on other trips. Mm-hmm. And then after the rescue, I started getting good wind, and I started feeling really, really positive, like maybe I was catching up. And I didn't really know whether I was or whether I wasn't, but the truth is I was actually catching up in that time leading up to Hobart. And then I got back into the South Pacific where I was again struggling with these calms. So I knew that I was, you know, amongst those in front of the fleet, but I knew that Simon was ahead of me the whole time. And I must honestly say, I not being able to go as far south as I wanted to, I didn't think until I was told that I was the first to pass Cape Horn that I was stood much chance of really ever catching up to that.
Did that change at that moment did that change your mindset in terms of how hard you would push the boat?
I think I was pushing really hard anyway, because while I was only halfway through the race, I told myself nonetheless, there's a lot of race left. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of room to catch up, and there's a lot that can still happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think consistently throughout, I was pushing, pushing, pushing. But of course, after the horn, I was also pushing, and I felt like I'm on the home run now.
Yeah. You
know? So so that's why getting stuck for such a long period in the doldrums was even all the harder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when we were talking to Bruce, and he, at one point, see, he had broken his boom twice on previous races, and he had some gnarly moments in the Southern Ocean. And he said at that time. He goes, I'm glad I didn't break the boom, but he decided he would just dial it back a little bit and focus on finishing.
Okay. Yeah.
So you didn't have any moment where you thought, I need to scale it back a little bit, but you were constantly.
Doldrums aside, I think the only time I kind of was trying to tell myself, I was trying to cheer my own self up in the doldrum, saying, look, maybe you can't win it, but, you know, be prepared for that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment the wind came back from the doldrums, I was giving it all I could, you know.
Provisioning. What was provisioning like during this trip? Did you, every time you, like, how often did you get to provision? Was it just the beginning? Was it certain points throughout?
You weren't allowed any help or provisioning during the trip. So you had to take everything with from the start that would see you through right till the end.
That is a lot of provisioning, isn't it? Like for a typical journey or whatever. That seems incredible to me. So now I saw in one video you were making something that reminded you of home or whatever. Yeah. How much of that did you have? Like, were you provisioning? Is it like an astronaut going into space where it's very specific and you can't allow yourself pleasures? Or did you provision, you know, were you able to enjoy what you ate or, you know?
Yeah, well, definitely. Well, for one, that's one of the reasons I chose the Cape George as well, because mm-hmm. it's a heavy boat by design.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, everyone was going to have to take a lot of provisions with them.
Yeah.
So I just thought, well, heavy boat's going to deal with a heavy load better than a light design boat mm-hmm. would, for example, like Tapio's boat.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing is I'm not really a racer, right? So I didn't have that mindset of, you know, I've got to cut the handle of my toothbrush off to save that extra bit of weight.
Totally.
For me, I was thinking it's a long trip. I want to stay healthy, you know, physically, but I also need those mental comforts, like some nice food when I need it, or mm-hmm. a book to read when I want to, you know, have a book to read.
Mm-hmm. Or a shot of rum when you rescue somebody.
Or a shot of rum when you rescue someone, or when you want to toast Neptune, or whatever it mm-hmm. is that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually provisioned well with good food, some of them, you know, in jars that weighed more, whatever the case may be. And I was very unscientific about my provisioning. And and how I went about it is I did my first long trip from Canada to South Africa as a shakedown. And then I kind of looked, okay, I ate a lot of that. I ate less of this. I've still got a lot of that left over.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was in Cape Town. I'm like, I've got a car now, so I better stock up on a whole lot of things, and mm-hmm. especially stuff from home. And then I did, you know, a final stock up in Europe. But it was not like an astronaut at all, where you had to stick to this as your diet and so many calories. So it was quite a varied diet, and I could have kept going for another maybe 6 to 8 weeks if I had to.
So is that a real thing? Taking the handle off a toothbrush.
I'm told so. I've never done it.
That's insane.
You'd have to ask Bruce.
Yeah. So what were some of the foods from home? Like what are the things that remind you of home?
Well, one thing that's nice to take with is biltong, which is beef jerky.
Yeah, I've heard so much about that
version. Yeah.
So everybody loves that. I've got to try it.
It's really nice and it lasts forever. So it's good food for a boat.
Yeah.
And then that thing that you were talking about that I was, you know, cooking on the boat was, it's like cornmeal that you can make the stodgy mess out of it, or porridge or whatever. And it just tastes like home to me.
Nice.
Mm. And then certain like chocolates or candies or whatever that you get back home.
Mm-hmm.
A rooibos tea, those kind of things.
I wonder if your provisioning, not like a racer, was an advantage, you know, like mentally, like because you were able to enjoy yourself a little bit, what you ate and
I mean, my personal opinion is yes. And I think, you know, you have to obviously have some racy sort of way of going about something like that. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, this is such a long race that you don't want to suffer for 8 months.
Suffer as little as,
You know, and I was
like
out
to suffer
there
a day.
I was really out there enjoying myself. The other thing I had is a French chef gave me 100 little jars of homemade meals that he, you know, canned in jars. And he just came along and said, yeah, I'm a French chef and this is what I do. Would you like some jars? And I said, sure.
Awesome.
But I didn't know he wasn't going to bring me 100.
Yeah.
And everyone else said, you're surely not going to take them all because each jar weighs a kilo. And I'm like, I think Minahaha will deal just fine with it. So.
Nice.
And I saw you had a couple of hammocks and you had produce. How long did your produce last?
That's amazing because those pictures you saw were from after the race. Well, not the oranges and the stuff, but the onions and the garlic lasted 8 months at sea. So, yeah. So, and I was a bit lazy about chopping them as well because I was eating my little French gourmet meals.
I don't think lazy is the word.
I wouldn't use that either. I had a real quick question because, you know, we've been watching videos and reading interviews and so forth. And I saw, and we know in film and video, sometimes B-roll will be from a different time than when we're presenting. I saw a furler unit and Hankton sales. Can you describe a little bit of that? I mean, how did you handle your head sails?
Well, for the main head sail, I had a furling unit. And then for the staysail, I had Hankons.
So it's the staysail that we were seeing.
Unless you saw anything from the refit when I was sailing along the Newfoundland coast, there everything was just Hankon.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure. So I like to find out kind of moments. It could be during the race or just in your boating life in general, but basically like your craziest moment, your scariest moment, your most profound moment at sea. Do you have a scariest?
My scariest moment was actually delivering a catamaran across the Southern Indian Ocean and getting into like 70 knots and just huge swell coming up from behind. And this is a cruising cat that's built for relatively low speeds. And this thing surfing down waves at 20 knots.
Oh my gosh.
And thinking, this is not good.
What were you thinking? Were you thinking this could be it?
I don't think I was quite that pessimistic yet because I was also kind of also full of this adrenaline energy of, wow, this is cool. Yeah.
Being a surfer, this is a big surfboard.
Did you have any kind of drogue out at that point? Or
We were towing warp behind the boat. Okay, yeah. And then we had this huge wave crash into the cockpit of that catamaran. And fortunately, all three of us were inside in that moment. And we had the sliding doors, but it was like this green wall of water hitting the doors. And then it knocked the doors off their rails. And then the boat instantly took on, 200 liters of water. And there were three of us on board. And one of the guys, he was getting like all red in his face. And I could tell that's stress. This guy's now seriously stressed.
Yeah.
So that was kind of scary, but also adrenaline.
Yeah.
And then on Minnehaha down in the Southern Ocean, I also had fantastic conditions. It was like 40, 50 knots and nice swell coming from behind. And I had this special twin, you know, head sail rig with the two poles. And the boat was just flying down the waves like she was shooting a rooster tail off her stern.
Wow.
And I didn't have a GPS, so I couldn't see what speed she was getting. But I know she was surfing at some crazy speeds. And I was thinking, this is probably not normal for, you know, a 13-ton Cape George, but this is cool.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of fun. What about just breathtaking moments where you feel like nobody else on the planet is going to see this? You know, like just it could be anything, just some profound moment at the ocean at sea.
Well, one really special experience I had was actually a whale in the sort of close to Ascension Island in the Atlantic. We didn't have much wind, so the boat was slow and this whale was there. And I thought, well, let's furl away everything and see if we can swim with the whale. And must have been a young minke whale. And I think I spent about 2 or 3 hours in the water. And this thing just kept on coming and circling and turning onto its back. And I'd see its stomach, you know, wearing a mask. And at times, it really was so close, it felt like it's two arm's lengths away from me. And that was like maybe one of the most special wildlife interactions I've had.
That's beautiful.
That is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the beginning it was intimidating because it's such a big animal. And then as you realize that it's a really, really peaceful presence.
Gentle
and that
giant.
And mutual curiosity, you know, for each other. That was very cool.
I love whale curiosity. I watch a lot of whale videos and just, they're amazing animals. Jumping off in the middle of the ocean, jumping off your boat.
Was talking about
I'm going to go back
earlier.
To this again because
he's like, wow.
You know, I watched Jaws as a kid, And ever since then, you know, I was a surfer. I had some, you know, I saw sharks and stuff. But I definitely built up an intense fear of sharks and being on the menu. and deep water. You can't see. You know, there's a phobia about that. I don't know if I have it specifically, but it seems to me the idea of doing that, latching your tiller and jumping off and even swimming away from your boat and kind of like toying with being stranded in the middle of what you said was basically what eternity. Mm-hmm. I can feel it right now, even just talking about it. On one hand,
your blood pressure.
Well, no, on one hand, excitement. Like, mm-hmm. I know what you're saying, but I could never just get to that point where I jump off. Maybe. I mean, but what's that like for you? What are you dealing with inside? Do you ever have any fear? You know, like, I know people that fly, the chances of the plane going down, you know, you have more chance of getting hurt driving a car or whatever, but I, you know, you see enough plane crash movies and it's in your mind. Did you think about that ever when you're jumping off? Or are you just like,
well, in the places I was jumping off, it was usually in the tropics where it's kind of warm, mm-hmm. and in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, there I didn't ever think of sharks, because I've, in all the times I've crossed those areas, I've never seen a shark, and it just felt like totally normal to do it. But on the contrary, I know that Tasmania's got quite a lot of sharks around there, mm-hmm. and it's an unknown area to me. So I was becalmed, you know, not far from Tasmania, and I really needed to get into the water and scrape some barnacles. And just as I was contemplating the water, thinking I better do it now quickly, this little shark pops up. And it was a small shark, mm-hmm. but it was a shark nonetheless. And that was a good enough reason for me to say, okay, I'm definitely not doing that now because they're sharks. But on the same token, it was a job I was dreading. So it was also a nice excuse. It's like, ah, there's a shark. I definitely can't do it today, you know, or ever in this area, which, mm-hmm. of course, was nonsense, because at the end of the day, you know, I realized that it's just some psychological nonsense.
100%.
And there came a point where the barnacle problem was just getting really bad. And I had to say, look, okay, if sharks or not, this has to be done now. And then I didn't think of them anymore.
I'm fully aware that it's psychological, but nevertheless, it has its hold on me. But just, again, inspirational, the things that you do and you face your fears. So back to the race, when did you get the feeling that you were going to win?
I briefly had that feeling when I got around the horn, mm-hmm. and I knew that I was in the lead. Mm-hmm. And then I lost that feeling when I got stuck in the doldrums. And I didn't actually after that think I was going to win anymore. But I kept on saying, maybe there's a tiny little hope. And if there's a tiny hope, I have to push the boat really, really hard. Mm. So then I did, and especially towards the end, I was sprinting as fast as I could,
and
thinking maybe there's a chance.
And what was the moment that you knew you won?
Only really when I was almost over the finish line, because what happened is I got becalmed maybe 7 miles out from the finish line, so I could see Le Sable de Dolan, I could see the end, but I had no wind. And even as that happened, I saw a sailboat with a blue spinnaker. And even then still did I think it was Abalash Tomy ahead of me. Oh, so boy. It was really only right towards the end. And when the boats came out and started waving me in, there was someone who said, do you realize that you're about to win? And then I thought, no, I think this is a bad joke. You know, I'm not even going to buy into these kind of stories, because what if it's not true? So, yeah.
So right till the last moment. Wow. Man, how emotional was that?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, in a way, it was a very gentle arrival, being becalmed and having to drift for hours and hours to get over the start line. So I had time to process everything. And there was so much happening around me that I couldn't really absorb everything in one moment. You know, I was seeing people again, which was already a big thing. Then I was seeing people I knew. Then I was seeing team members. Then I saw my mother. So there was a lot happening all simultaneously.
That's what I was thinking, is that, you know, you spend all that time alone. And it just must have been surreal, maybe an out-of-body experience or mm-hmm. something like that. Just can you remember it? Like, can you, if you're thinking back, do you remember?
I can. Yeah, it's imprinted pretty well in my mind. And I hope it stays there, because, you know, it's a special moment. I can still relive in memories. I think in the moment, I realized there's a moment that's going to pass very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I kept on saying, enjoy this moment because soon it'll be over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to remind myself that all the time, but it's a good thing to remind yourself
did
of.
Did you at any point in the days right after that race, did you think, I want to do this again?
I don't think I directly thought I want to do this again, but I thought often, I wish it wasn't over yet. I want to go back, as in looking back to a time that you can never go back to. Because, of course, I could do it again if I wanted to, but it won't be the same.
No.
You know? That was like the moment, and it can't be repeated. And I think for that reason, I wouldn't try and do it again, because that would be like trying to revisit a time and a place that you were in. But you can't. You can revisit the place, but you can't revisit that exactly how it came about.
Well, there's always the race to Alaska, Bondi.
Well, and this is it, you know, time for new challenges.
So. Yes.
Yeah. So again, watching that video of you finishing, well, the song, that was really cool.
Oh, that was really cool. That was a great surprise as well.
And that the artist's name?
Lenny Gallant.
Yeah, Gallant. I just didn't know how to pronounce the last name, but... So he actually has some really good music, and you were saying you kind of got into his music. You were allowed cassettes, and you had a cassette.
Yeah, exactly. And I met him on Prince Edward Island, and he and Patricia, who make the music together, they became friends. Mm-hmm. So it was even more special because there was so much of that whole Prince Edward Island and the Minnehaha Reef are tied into that song. So
how does it feel to have a song like that? Like, that must be so cool. It's a great song.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. It's very special.
Yeah, it wouldn't have existed without you. That's amazing.
True.
So that finishing moment again, I think the part that just sticks out to me the most is because I'm really close with my mother, and just seeing your mom there. How special was that for her? Are you just so glad that she got to see that moment and be a part of that, and you're winning? I mean, that must have been huge for your mom as well.
Yeah, I was really, really glad. I'm glad she could travel all the way from South Africa. I'm sure it wasn't easy for her to get there, especially not knowing when I was going to arrive, because a lot of people had to keep on rebooking their flights because I was getting faster, and I was, you know, the time was drawing ahead of it. So it was... Really, I'm happy that she could be there.
That's so awesome. And I love that there's video of your mom out on the bow of your boat.
My favorite shot. Yeah,
that was just amazing. Because, you know, again, I'm just picturing my mom and knowing how special that relationship is. And that's just really cool. Meant a lot.
Yeah, it was cool. Actually, it was quite a funny moment when I was becalmed and I saw my mother on a boat, and she saw me. And she said to the skipper, she said, I'm getting onto her boat. Get closer now. And I said to her, you can't. I'm not over the finish line yet. Yeah. I'll get disqualified.
Yeah, that's assisted. Imagine if. But anyway, amazing. Thank you for sharing that story. You know, you just, we feel very privileged to have you as a guest.
Yes.
And thank you for taking the time in your visit here to be with us. I did want to ask, Minnehaha is obviously a very special boat. You still own her.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a dream boat beyond Minnehaha for you? Is there something that, you know, one day I could get that boat or anything like that? Or is she's not here, so she can't hear you.
Yeah. Well, I did always like a certain type of French aluminum boat that also it has a dagger board as opposed to a big weighted keel, but it's a pretty cool boat because it's really robust, and again, you can reduce the draft and you can go up rivers, and it seems like a really cool exploring boat. You can dry it out and, you know, work below the waterline and stuff like that if you have to. So for me, that if I had to choose my absolute dream boat, it would maybe be something like that, just because it's strong and you can go anywhere with it without it, you know, being really, really big and heavy. But I still own Minnehaha, and until I've kind of decided if I'm going to keep her or not, I can't really think of other boats.
I understand completely.
Yeah.
All right. So if people want to find out more about you, obviously they can go to KirstenGGR.com. It's Kirsten, KIRSTEN, GGR.com. You're on Instagram at KirstenGGR, YouTube at Kirsten Neuschafer GGR and also Facebook, Kirsten Neuschafer GGR.
We'll put those up.
Yep,
we'll right have here them all. So people can read them and we'll link to it in the comments section.
Absolutely. And I totally recommend just do a deep dive. Take a night, you know, put a couple hours aside, watch the videos, watch her, the race. What is the couple that did the like a 2 hour video?
Sailing Magic Carpet.
Yeah. Sailing Magic Carpet. go check out their channel and their video with Kirsten. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. Like from when I started doing research till literally this morning when I was driving here, I was playing one of your videos in the car as I was coming. I wasn't watching. I was only listening. is there anything anywhere you would like to direct people or anything that you would like to?
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, some of the better YouTube videos aren't on my actual YouTube channel, but they're from the Golden Globe race itself. So,
but you have some great videos on your channel, and you are keeping up to date on all your social media, so there's always stuff to see. And what's coming up? You're here in Port Townsend.
Yep, I'm here in Port Townsend, and you know, I don't know. Who knows?
You're just riding the waves, whatever comes.
I'm just riding
the
waves and, you enjoy. Know, seeds are being planted and talk of, you know, all sorts of other fun races that exist.
Well, we can't wait to find out more. And thank you again. It's really
thank
been
you. It's
a privilege
been really
having
fun.
You.
Thank you. I'm privileged to be here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kirsten.
Close your eyes. Hear the voice within. Call it. This heavy load got your skin, all in. You got the white knuckles holding on it tight, keeping your feelings bottled up inside. Heading for a collision in the night. To really live, you gotta die. Breathe in, breathe out. Hey, come, come, come alive. Breathe in. There's a heart gone.